I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, if it's Thursday, that means we're normally doing the Lynch and Kenny event, and we're doing that this morning. So joining me from Texas, where he was doing some Iwo Jima stuff yesterday, Tim Lynch. Tim, good morning. What's going on?
Yeah, not much, Mac. I'm glad to be here.
All right. We'll catch up with what you've been doing here the last couple days here in a second. Jeff Kenny joins us from Southern California. Jeff, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. This is my peak time.
early in the morning. Early in the morning, it all goes downhill from there. All right, we're going to talk a little bit about Iwo Jima today. Timmy, you were at the Marine Military Academy in Texas. It's a high school. What were you doing there yesterday?
Well, at the Marine Memorial Academy there, Military Academy, is the mold on which the National Monument was based. It was the Felix D. Weldon's mold that he gave to that school. So they have a parade where the entire Corps of Cadets, which is what they essentially are, in dress blues, by the way, pass in review. And they lay a wreath at the base of the Iwo Jima Memorial. Yesterday they had a Navy veteran who made six trips back and forth in the Higgins boats. He was carrying medical supplies in and wounded out, and he was there to help lay the wreath. And we had, I believe, a cousin of Harlan Block, who was one of the flag raisers. He's from Weslaco, which is right down the road, and he was also there. And the kids did a very good pass and review parade. They were pretty good. And if you saw the sergeant major that's in charge of drill there, who's this gigantic, hard-looking African-American guy, you'd understand why they look so good in that parade. But it was it wasn't like watching Eighth and I, but it was better than watching a lot of other parades. It was pretty nice. It was a great ceremony.
So how long is that? So it's a Marine Military Academy. Does it have any relation to the Marine Corps officially, or just something that's got stood up in the Marine Corps' likeness?
Because you and
Jeff both have connections there, right?
Well, yeah, Colonel Chris Dowling is now the president of the school, and Jeff and I know him. I was in 1-8 with him. We were on recruiting duty together. Jeff knows him. He was the guy that made that phone call to Lori after he got hit. But so Chris is a good guy.
Yeah, he's one of the guys who pulled me out of that ditch after my vehicle got blown up.
I thought he was there. That's right. I thought he was there. So we know Chris. As a Marine Corps League vice president, I get invited to all these things anyway. So the Marine Corps League was out there in force. And I got to say, there was 400 people. Not a great day, overcast and cool. Almost 100% of them would have been veterans, though. Most of them are winter veterans. General Halick is what we call a winter Texan. He comes down to Weslaco for the winter with his wife. He was there. And it was primarily veterans that were watching this thing, and there was a lot of them because there's a lot of them around here in the summer, in the wintertime during the cold weather up north.
The and Texas, as you mentioned, Harlan Block country. There's the great story relative to Harlan Block not being in that Ira Hayes hitchhiked and walked to meet the Block family, right? And then
that's right.
And then he writes a letter that says that, you know, that Harlan Block was in that flag raising. And the famous story of Harlan Block's mother saying, "I know my son's butt, and that's his butt."
Exactly. And one of his And one of his cousins was there also, because Harlan Block is his final resting place is right behind that memorial. And after the parade, the cadets formed up there, and they laid a wreath to Harlan. Our chaplain for our Marine Corps League is a former Weslaco County Sheriff, and he was there when they received his remains from Okinawa, I believe, in 80s or 90s, somewhere down in there. And he said, hey, all that was in there were just a bunch of bones. He goes, I'm not even so sure that's Harlem Block. So, but be that as it may, I don't think they were doing DNA testing that far back. I know they weren't. So,
no, it would have been, right? That was him. It would have been in under the cross that says Harlem Block with this number on it. Were these remains, right, in this container or not in a container, just a bag, and that those got – yeah, you're right. That's how they did it. I don't know. I would say pretty accurate system because it was pretty simple yet accurate. Your dog tags were on you or they were on a piece of your body, and I don't know. I think I would tend to say relatively accurate, short of DNA, right?
Yeah, I would too. I absolutely
do. You either one of you guys know? So the way the monument gets made is, and you see pictures of Felix de Weldon, right, carving the essentially the statue, right, and then what they do is they pour bronze over that, and then they do whatever they do, they shine it up and however they do it, and then that's what the monument is. How did the carving get to Texas? How did it get to this high school, essentially? Any idea?
It was given by the Felix de Weldon family. I given the size, I imagine it got there because it was in Newport, Rhode Island. When I lived in Newport, Rhode Island, I could see that from the street of his where his mansion was. You could look into the garage and see it in there. So I would bet you money it came by boat. Because it's
how did they even did they say they wanted to get
huge.
I wonder
it's like actual size
yeah exactly uh-huh it's
well
huge.
It would have to be if it was what they made it out of. I mean, I don't want to be
right. Yeah, I would guess a boat to Brownsville and you would have to get a special
no how did they truck. Even how did they even make the connection? I mean, how does it wind up in Texas? I mean, it were they going to throw it out and these guys said, hey, we'll take it, we'll pay for it to come down here? How in the hell did that thing wind up in the custody of that high school?
Well, that high school has a board of prominent Marines who service it, and they had started a museum already built around Harlan Block's collection, you know, stuff dedicated to him. So they were already in the business of trying to procure and maintain artifacts, and they're still trying to get one of the original smaller statues that he made, because there's about 10 of those around that they're trying to get their hands on. I think that the de Weldon family donated that. It's a 501c, so they probably got you know, there was tax advantages behind, but I don't believe anybody else was asking for that, quite frankly, because I mean, this is a while ago. Yeah
I don't know. Jeff, do you have any insight into any of that?
Yeah, I hear you, Mac, now.
Okay. Do you have any insight into how the de Weldon sculpture got to the Marine Military Academy in Texas? You know a lot about a lot of shit.
I was thinking maybe like the way they brought the Statue of Liberty over, just like Tim said, by sea, you know, by barge in pieces.
No. I don't mean,
I know that's how they did this.
I don't mean how it physically got there.
Or you mean the.
Yeah, what was the connection?
Physically, you mean politically, how it got down there? Or what?
Yeah, how did it even get there in the first place?
I don't know. I mean, I'll tell you what, though. I'll find out or this weekend. I'm going to be there on the 27th, 28th.
Well, and again, Jeff has been awesome. And you know, we've been talking about, you know, I just did post-traumatic winning yesterday here for the Space Command in Colorado Springs. And so, I mean, people came up to me and said, you know, there should be a version of this in high schools. But, you know, the problem is the behavioral health people in schools and, like, what kids can see and the liability and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, should. Yep.
Right. And so the model, like, right, would be a private school with a board that would say, yeah, this is good and our kids need to see it and we get it and all of that. And just been great at maybe hopefully opening a door. And so it will go into a high school for the first time ever. And maybe that'll be the way we do it is it'll go to private schools first. And then slowly but surely, maybe through osmosis, get into the public school system.
Well, a fertile place to try will be with Chris. And I'm looking forward to seeing him and Jeff next weekend. It's going to be awesome.
So Jeff's going down there to speak? Is that what you're doing down there next week, Jeff?
I'll cover for him when he tries to reestablish.
You're going down there to speak next week?
Yes. I'm gonna it's actually a leadership forum and I'm they're broken into groups and I'm gonna honcho one of the groups.
Guest
speaker is supposed to be
who? Yeah.
The guest speaker is originally going to be Lieutenant General Smith, but he may not be able to get there. So they're looking at John Glover, a Silver Star winner Marine from the Iraq conflict, to step in and do the guest speaking part.
Got it. The all right. So is it a 1 day event? Is it multiple days? How many days will you be down there?
It is.
Got it.
It's the 28th, so 1 day. So I'm going to go from there to see my mom in Florida.
What a good sign.
I'll get a chance to see Timmy. Yeah. Well, she's 86. Yeah. It's her 86th birthday on the 1st. So.
Even a better son. Yeah. You just went from an okay son to a really good son. Never miss your mom's birthday.
Yeah, well, Lori's making me do it.
You shouldn't admit to that. The All right, we were late last week. We were talking about this week, and the 75th anniversary of Marines going ashore on Iwo Jima, and we've all read a bunch, and so thought we'd talk about that for a little bit. to me, is there any part of that battle that fascinates you any more than any other part?
Yeah, well, it's hard to pick apart because you've got 36 days of sustained violence, right? There's no grand maneuvers. There's no decisions being made. You had, I think, one regimental unsupported night attack that was very successful, would be the only deviation from the constant grind. And what amazes me is I don't know how they did it, because – they had to basically
organize. Ninth Marines you're talking about there, a night attack, right, Tim?
Colonel Kenyon.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was talking about. And that's the only – I mean, other than that, it's a daily grind. And as you read – because if you want to study the battle, you're invariably drawn into these narratives. And they're fascinating, but –
Yeah,
but
I think Iwo Jima, the prime example. Right.
Yeah.
Wait, go ahead. Hold on, Jeff. Timmy, go ahead and finish. Fascinating.
Prime example of Marine Corps adaptability, because the Japanese, as many people have said. Okay, I'm sorry.
Jeff is doing a better job of making my point than I was, exactly what I was getting at.
It sounds like we're on some kind of delay. I don't know if it's our connection, but Jeff is getting things a few seconds after. But just go ahead, Timmy.
I'm trying to get on my phone.
Okay.
Just use my phone because it's cutting in and out.
Do you want to hang up and just call me on your phone?
Sounds like you cut out again. Hey,
all right, go ahead.
Well, I'll go ahead and finish up. That is the thing about it that amazes me, is the adaptability as guys went forward and tasked, organized themselves, and still were able to make any kind of progress, because I was on Iwo Jima at the 50th anniversary, and I had the maps, I had the big old book out, I'm looking at the map, you're looking at divisions and regiments charging where we wouldn't be comfortable with a rifle company as far as bunching up, and under constant mortar and machine gun fire. It's amazing to read, and it's amazing that they made the progress they did, because Kurabayashi wanted to bleed them so badly that they wouldn't think of coming to Japan, and he would have had he faced a different foe, I want to say, because I'm a Marine.
Wow. How many times have you been to the island? I've never been. In fact, where I'm staying, I'm in Denver right now. I'm staying with Gary Kling, retired colonel, call sign Static, F-18 guy. He was our air officer in Ramadi in 2004. He's the air officer for the 1st Marine Division during both Fallujah attacks. He's just he's an awesome guy, and he's funny as hell. But he told me, right, being stationed out there, they would fly guys to Iwo Jima and to promote them and shit, right?
Oh,
yeah. He said, I've been there a ton of times. He said, went to the first time, and then, you know, we're largely unsupervised because we fly in and we fly out. And, you know, went into the caves and stuff. And he said, but, you know, we didn't have the equipment. And so, so the next time he said, I went back, he said, we had headlights. We had knee pads, we had elbow pads, we had water. And so we went down into those caves, and we went a ways into those caves. And I was like, are you kidding me?
Whoa.
And yeah. he said, no. So what was it like? He said, well, you know, you'd get in, you'd go through the winding openings, and, he said, you'd go through the winding opening, and then you'd get to a place where it opened up, and it would be cavernous. And then you'd get into that, and then you'd look up, and there'd be these, like, chimneys that went up, and that's where the spider holes were. And so then, you know, they'd go up there. There'd be steps cut into the wall that they would go up, and then there'd be, you know, the shooting apertures up there. And then, you know, when they would be discovered, then they would, they'd drop back down. And he said, whatever you did to that opening, you know, just some metal might rain and dirt might rain down into the major kind of opening down below where they moved through. He said, it was amazing. He said, there's still like all kinds of shit down there, you know? And I was like, wow. Yeah. I think Jeff's back with us. Are you there, Jeff? Hello?
Oh, man.
Earth to Kenny. Jeff, you there?
Well, yeah, I don't hear anything from him. But I went once. It was 25 years ago today. And what we were providing, I was the 3-for-1-8, and we were providing a static display for the survivors, both Japanese and Americans who were being flown out there. But I was a 3. I think I just hit Brian Wilhoit up so he'd go out there and supervise him so I could scamper away and go exploring with the maps, because we were warned. No, under no circumstances were we to remove sand or any other objects from the island. And I had my Alice pack on with those Marine Corps history books in the thing. And I left those there because I had it full of sand. And I told the Marines. The Marines were like, sir, what do you think about that? I said, I don't think that sounds like a legal order. I don't know how we're not supposed to take sand. That doesn't sound right to me.
You there, Jeff?
Yes, I am.
All right, I think I just cut Timmy off. Let me see if I can add Timmy to the conversation here. We'll see if we can make this work. Add people. Tim Lynch.
Okay. Are you okay?
Hold on a second. I'm on with Jeff.
Okay. Now I can hear. I can hear Timmy now. Jeff, are you here?
Oh, there you go.
Now we're waiting to see if Jeff shows up.
I'm here, Matt.
Okay. All right. We got everybody. I don't know. Can you guys hear each other?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So we're just talking, Jeff, about having been to the island. Have you ever been to the island?
I have not. It's a frustration of mine.
Yeah,
I had like my stepsons get there, I never have. I got a lot of sand. That's about it.
No, I'm the same way, man. I've read about that place. I've collected images. I follow the battle, but I like the where I'm staying. Gary Kling, he's an F-18 guy. He said they used to fly guys out and promote them there, and that After the first time he went, he was just fascinated. So the next time he went back, he took knee pads, elbow pads, you know, headlights, and he said, we went all through those caves. And he said it was just amazing. And I was like ready to choke him. I'm like, you're an F-18 guy, man. Like, you know, but
yeah.
Is there a part of the battle that fascinates you more than any other part?
Well, I have to tell you, the personal history of the actual flag raising platoon is fascinating to me. I mean, when I first came to Quantico to work at the basic school, you know, as an almost captain, I remember running into you. You were telling me, you know, that someone told you, I think General Zinni, you should take one battle, learn everything about that. You were doing Iwo Jima. We were talking about that night attack Timmy mentioned, the 9th Marines night attack. And the 3rd Marines came in on the 5th day of the battle. 3rd Marines with 2 regiments, and the 9th Marines did that night attack. We're talking about that. That was the same time, almost simultaneously, the basic school was visited by Lieutenant Keith Wells, who was the platoon commander of the guys in Echo 228 put the flag up. Apparently, that platoon had a Medal of Honor. They had a lieutenant and a platoon sergeant got the Navy Cross subsequent to the actual flag raising. A bunch of Silver Stars. That guy, Chick Lindbergh, who you've talked about, the flamethrower kid.
Yeah.
And there's a great book called by Richard Wheeler called Iwo. Wheeler was actually one of the members of that stuff. So it was, you know, it always fascinated me. But that part of it, you know, it's always been, you know, the 28th Marines, what they went through. Wells was wounded, evacuated, taken down the bunkers that basically were boarding Suribachi and evacuated, but then went UA from the hospital ship back to the battle. And when the battalion commander found out about it, personally ordered him off. That battalion commander who was later killed by mortar fire, Chandler Johnson. So it was very interesting to me, that whole thing about those guys. And then when I became the CO of Pittsburgh, one of them, the Sergeant Strank, he was from a town in Western PA there in my area.
Yeah, you know,
so it was always
General Furness just went up, I want to say last year, and gave a speech on I think it was February 19th, when they honor Mike Strank in his hometown. And yeah, he's talking about what an incredible honor. You know, when we were at the basic school, all of a sudden I'm over at IOC, and it's General Zinni, when, you know, he did that PME that night that changed my lives and a lot of other guys' lives, I know, too. But he talks about this night attack. He talks about, you know, pick a battle. And he talked about, you know, Iwo Jima, and that he had, you know, I've taken my household allowance has gone up like 400 pounds from the sand I've taken off that place. He said, there's all kinds of fascinating stuff in that battle. And he said the way they used recon did rear area securities. What else are you going to do with recon? Put them out in front of your lines by 1 meter, right? And so, I mean, it's just hilarious. And he said, and what they had was, he said, there was guys that practiced maneuver warfare there. What is maneuver warfare? Elastic tactics, swift decision, blah, blah, blah. And he talks about Graves Erskine. He said Graves Erskine was the CO of the 3rd Marine Division. He said, and one of my predecessors, so Zinni had just given up 9th Marines, is a colonel by the name of Kenyon. And he said, he calls Kenyon in and says, Kenyon, we're going to do a night attack. And Kenyon looks at him and says, you got to be shitting me. We don't do night attack. And Erskine says, we're only going to do one. It's going to be at the right time, right? And we're going to break their backs with it. And he said, so, right, on the night, Kenyon, and it's actually early in the morning, right, between like, you know, 2 and 4 in the morning, you know, they do it, except they attack the wrong hill. He said, but the Japanese are so stunned by it that they can't react. And then Kenyon moves to the right place as the sun comes up. He unfucks himself. But Zinni, so Zinni, you know, to me, Zinni the burning bush, right? If that's what he says, and I've been fascinated by Iwo Jima since I was a kid, so I started doing that. I get a phone call one day. Hey, there's a guy here who was a platoon commander on Iwo Jima would you guys want to, hang out with him and have lunch with him? And I'm like, are you shitting me? Like, yes. So I go over and I meet Keith Wells. And Keith Wells, he's in his 70s. He was a big dude. He was probably like 6'3", right? He's a big guy. Had a mustache. He was living in Texas. And he wrote a book. It was something like, give me 20 Marines and I'll,
I'll take any position.
Exactly. And so he comes over and, I bust the maps out and it's Major Allen and me and, Scott Saab, Brian Fitzgibbons. I don't know if you were there, Timmy.
I absolutely was. Me and Kennedy both were.
Right. Yeah. So, and we're just in the room like salivating, listening to him. And, he's part of, kind of the right flank of the 5th Marine Division in the movement across the base of Suribachi. So he winds up on the far side. He said, and we had trained every night in training to put out concertina wire. He said, so like a dumbass, he said, I'm bouncing out concertina wire in front of our position. And then the other two lieutenants in my company, they see me do it, and they're like, oh, shit, I guess I'm supposed to do that too. He said, they both get shot. One of them gets killed. And he said, and I felt horrible about that because that shit didn't do us any good. He said, and here I am. He said, hell, half their holds were behind our wire, right. And he said, and so, I've always felt bad that, one of my good friends was killed. But he tells this story about moving across the neck of the island that day. And he said, we could hear all these, all these Japs in this bunker. And so we got a thermite grenade. Right. And I had a Thompson machine gun and there's two other Marines and we stood outside the opening, right, waiting for them. And we throw the thermite grenade in through the opening, the machine gun aperture, and they start screaming and yelling. And then he said it felt like a couple minutes. It probably wasn't that long. But the door comes open and they come running out. They're all crouched over, every one of them, and the smoke's billowing out, has the bayonet scabbard of the guy in front of him, and all you could see is their boots, their tabby shoes with the toe and all that shit, and their leg wrappings as they came out. And he said there must have been 15 or 20 of them. And then he said, and I took my Thompson machine gun and laid him out for inspection.
Right? Yeah, I remember being, but I was still an EI company. I was Untermenschen, so I didn't actually meet him. I remember you guys talking about it. At the same time, you were talking about General Zinni saying, pick a battle and really key into it, Yeah. And he just died. He died in 2006.
Right.
I knew at that exact moment when he said, and I laid him out for inspection, that it'll never be that cool. How cool was it? Because it's this big old Texan guy, and he's talking this dead serious. And we know what a 45 caliber does. We know how that works. And he just said it just like that. And I thought, I'll never be Iwo Jima cool, man. That was just awesome.
Well, and you talk about the perfect use of that weapon, right? In close quarters, right? Snub nose and all the rest of it, that was what that weapon was designed for. But I mean, that's what they did. They just, and I think, I can't remember which one you said it, but I mean, Iwo Jima is a blue collar fight, man. It is like we're gonna get it on with these motherfuckers, and we're gonna find out who's tougher. And the Japanese were tough, But at the end of the day, we had more. And you think about 60,000 people, 40,000 Marines, 20,000 Japanese soldiers on that island, fucking Thunderdome, man. And no prisoners were being taken. I mean,
and it doesn't stop. I believe the Atlantic Beach was under continuous fire for the first 96 hours, if not longer.
Long.
I mean, it never stopped. Never.
Because they were pop up. Like your buddy there, the F-18 guy, he probably has a little bit more of a, visceral understanding of falling in those. And they're degraded now, not like they were in February, March of 45 when they were. I think we dropped so much ordnance and pounded so much. I think we started in June of 44 pounding that place. And I don't know if it killed one Japanese. It didn't do enough damage to seriously impede them.
No, I don't know if you were on the call, Jeff, but my buddy you know, when he went back, they went deep into those caves. And he said, you know, he had to kind of snake your way into them, right, which is kind of their own security method. And then it opened up into these big caverns. And then from the caverns, there'd be these, like, chimneys that would go up, and they would have little steps in the side of the wall, and that's how you went up. And then you would shoot from that, and then you would just duck down. Once you ducked down, you were safe, right?
Yep.
You were safe. Right. And until they blasted them, the whole blind and burn and blast them and shut them down and restricted you, and then found a way to, you know, either burn the cave up or throw explosives in it and shut part of it down. And he said, though, it was just, you could see how they could survive there. And you could see how the prep, right, whether it be aerial or naval guns, it didn't do shit to those guys. They just sat there and waited.
You know, I have to say, President Roosevelt died while we were fighting on Iwo Jima. But he had a connection to the Marine Corps because his son was a Marine Raider. Right. So he was hearing about what the Marines were going through in Iwo Jima. He proposed, this is right before he died, using poison gas on that because of the stuff that was coming out in early March and they turned it down, which is probably a good thing. But you can see why the desperation of it. Almost 7,000 guys killed. I think D-Day was the worst D-Day we ever had, like over between 400 and 500 KIA, maybe more, on that first day. That's incredible. You know, that's two Beirut bombings together in one day, you know.
And you could stand on that red beach and look at the entire length of that of the initial landings, and with a reasonably competent infantry battalion, you could have turned that place into a meat grinder. And like I said, we're not talking a dozen machine guns. We're talking hundreds, not a dozen mortars, hundreds. It's just boggles the imagination of how momentum was ever even achieved and gained there. Because there's not a flat plane on that island that's not pockmarked with bullet holes. I mean, when you're looking at the terrain and whatnot, and climbing up Suribachi, that's a 7-minute walk. But not back then. It's hard to fathom the intensity and ferocity of that battle. I don't think there's ever been anything like it.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that Static said was, he said, you know, first of all, the beach, man, he said, when you get there, he said, what surprised you is how steep it is, and we've all heard about the soft sand, which ultimately was good for the Marines because it absorbed a lot of blast from a lot of ordnance. But he said, that's one thing. And he said, and the whole thing is under observation from not only Suribachi, you know, but other parts of the island. And so you're just naked, hammering your way ashore. And, you know, Timmy's point, too, is like, he said, you know, we landed two divisions abreast into that relatively small area. He said, think about it. When you think about the 1st Marine Division, think about it being, you know, on a beach that's less than a mile long. And you're like, oh shit, man. What do we do with everything? He said, now imagine two divisions, stuff trying to go through there. And then if you, and I said this the other day, and do you remember those books we all got? And I couldn't believe the Marine Corps gave this shit out, but we found out about like the official history of World War II. And there was like, right. I don't know how many volumes to it, but they were these
five
volumes bound in these leather, tan leather things. And we found out about it, and we all like made the trip to go over there to bring them back with these books. But in one of the, in the Iwo Jima book, there's a series of maps, and they're turquoise and yellow, and they mark the daily progress. Well, I scan these things, and when you flip through day by day really quick and you see how it goes through, you see the 4th Marine Division on the right. They land, they turn right, and they don't move for fuck for for weeks. I mean, and that is the amphitheater, the, you know, the meat grinder, turkey knob, you know, that is those things that are, you know, iconic in as pieces of the battle. But, you know, they measured, you know, literally measured gains in feet for most of that battle, the 4th Marine Division. And I believe they had the highest casualty rate as they, amazing.
You know, General Allen's father-in-law was the CO of 25th Marines. I mean, that's how I got to IOC, I think. You know, we're standing in R7, and he asked me if I had any relatives in the Marine Corps. I said, no, I'm the only jarhead, I think, sir. And he goes, I said, well, how about you, sir? And he goes, well, my father-in-law was the CEO of 25th Marines during the Second World War. And I knew the guy's name, Batchelder. And he looked at me and goes, how could you possibly know that?
Rain Man.
And I don't remember them all now, but Iwo Jima is always, it's what the Marine Corps is all about. 175 years in our history. Here's this amphibious thing. It lands, you're in a desperate straits against a fanatic enemy. No civilians there. The island itself is a singularly unpleasant place. It smells like fart gas all the time. And what a place to go and fight and die. What a test of, patriotism and, determination to do that. And, that's what makes the thing such a Marine. Iwo Jima means the Marine Corps more than anything else. It's the one thing people think about. You think about the Marine Corps, you think about that flag raising thing, and it's it was brutal. Nothing else came close. Even, there's awful battles. Saipan was terrible. Peleliu was terrible. Okinawa
was terrible.
Here, worst one. The Iwo, the ratio between killed and wounded is just out of the
park. No, I was talking to a guy. I went to that dinner last Saturday, and I met the guy I had interviewed. His name's Tony Kappa, these are just normal American guys, right? That went ashore, and the divisions that went ashore, the 4th and 5th divisions, had about 50% of them were, veterans from, Guadalcanal. They were paramarines. They were, as Marine Raiders and then they had the young guys too. And to me, one of the amazing stories is, I was interviewing, when I interviewed Cal Humphrey, who was a PFC on Iwo Jima, he and his brother are both on the island. His brother was a lieutenant, who's passed away, but he was, he talks about, I said, what's the best advice you ever got on the island? And he said, don't be the first one out of the fighting hole. And then he said, one of the things you learn is, in the Marine Corps, they pump us full of, hot air and piss and vinegar. And you learn that, you can die just like anybody else does. And so, you gotta be smart, and he said, I saw so many guys get killed so many different ways. Just stick your head up over the ledge and boom, right in the forehead. You just saw this stuff that on a daily basis was crazy. You'd watch guys you knew, bleed to death in front of you because, they were so badly wounded that there was nothing the corpsman could do. And you weren't going to risk the lives of stretcher bearers to bring him up, because you knew he was just going to die. So he just laid there and died and you watched it. And he said, it was awful. Just the, to me, that term meat grinder is really appropriate because you saw most companies take like 200% casualties. So that's everybody that goes ashore becomes a casualty. All the replacements become casualties.
Right? The company that flag up, the only two original guys was the company commander, Dave Severance. And one guy who had shrapnel in his belly were the only two originals from Echo 228 who got off that island when they finally pulled them out. Twice.
That's amazing.
When you read accounts from the survivors, there's a lot of guys that have put together some books where they string along these accounts. The writers, the historians say that they remember D-Day. And they remember the day they got hit, but in between, they need a lot of help and try to remember the sequence of events because to them, to the participant, it was all a blur. And without battle diaries and unit logs, it was impossible to understand what the hell had happened. And it's like I said, I've walked that terrain. I've thought of that. I cannot imagine being in that situation. And we've all been in some situations where the gods of flying metal seem to have watched out for us. But I mean, that was nothing compared to what these guys were experiencing 24 hours a day for every day they were on that island. It's just incomprehensible.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can never say after Iwo Jima that there's always something worse than what you're going through. And it's Iwo Jima. Usually there's a lot of other things before Iwo Jima, but you know, Iwo Jima is the worst thing. I have to tell you, I started really getting interested in it. That particular battle, I watched this movie when I was a kid. It was like a rerun. It's a Tony Curtis movie about Ira Hayes called The Outsider.
Right.
And it was brutal. I mean, Tony Curtis is a handsome guy. The guy was drunk. You know, they pretty much go through the story of him. So I started reading about it. Let me tell you guys, in the early 70s, the casualty count for Iwo Jima wasn't even 5,000 dead. But after Vietnam, you started reading more and more. By the time I got in the Marine Corps and I was leaving embassy duty and the book by Richard Wheeler came out, you know that blue book, The Marine Corps Story?
Right.
You find right. More accurate casualty counts. Or what they started actually counting, because it was politically incorrect, but the number of dead Marines in that short amount of time in that little place, you know, at that stage in the war, it came out as like 4,500 killed. You know, I'm reading these books, you know, from that time, and it took them 30 years to really admit that, hey, almost twice that many, like almost 7,000 KIA.
And right, and what, 13,000 wounded in that?
20 days.
You know? Yeah.
That's interesting.
No, in the Cal Humphrey interview, the way Cal gets wounded, I want to say he gets wounded on March 19th. So he's there for a month. You know, I want to say 28 days he's there for. And he's now a squad leader, and he's going to a tank, he said, which was a mistake, to talk on the rear phone that was on the tank. And he said, and they, you know, they saw tanks, and those tanks would catch everything. Would get shot at those tanks. And he said, I get shrapnel, right, in his upper torso and in my lower torso. And he said, and my intestine is hanging out, but I could walk. So they gave me morphine and they told me where the BAS was. And I started bounding in that direction and I was struggling. He said, then I think I fainted for a while. And then I came to, and slowly but surely I got there, you know, holding my intestines, right? You know, it reminds you when you hear that of, right, of when I hear John McCain in Post-Traumatic Winning say, well, it's not like I just walked out of 3 years of solitary confinement, right? And you hear like, what did he just say? 3 years of solitary confinement? Right, come on! Like, how are you ever right in the head? And Cal Humphrey said, "Yeah." He said, "I was." He said, "I was lucky. I was lucky to be able to walk and get there." You know, and he said, and "I knew I'd get there eventually." He said, "Unless a sniper got me." He said, "But he said I thought I would." But you hear those stories, you know. And here's a guy who grew up in Iowa, or Nebraska, and winds up on that island in that incredible. Incredible fight. And I agree with you, Jeff. I mean, to me is the quintessential Marine Corps fight. That along with the Chosen Reservoir. Okay, do you want to get it on? And this gets brutal and horrible, right? We're going to tighten our belt. We're going to grit our teeth. And we're going to fucking do this shit because we're Marines. And I have to, I have to say, I think that legacy, that statue of the flag raising casts a long shadow on anybody who gets on an airplane to fly to some place where you're going to go be a part of whatever happens in front of a hostile force. And I think we all think about it. You know, it's like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if there's a return flight in my future, but I do know this, right? I'm not going to fail the guys that depend on me. And I remember thinking about that. And I remember, it is that long shadow of that statue, of the legacy that those guys wrote, and Marines in Belly Wood and throughout history have written, that I think reverberates to the Marine Corps today, that still attracts people today, and the power of those images, the power. And again, now there's so much more you can read, and I think the museum just published more digitized photographs from the battle.
Yes.
I didn't see them, but I saw some stuff people wrote about them. They said they were awesome.
Just recently. I have to tell you guys, when I first took over IOC in 2001, that's when they dedicated the Korean Korean War Memorial in D.C. Right. And Sergeant Major, remember him? He'd always help us during the machine gun stuff. You had been a platoon sergeant, machine gun platoon sergeant, for Barber, you know, Captain Barber's company at Taktong Pass.
Right.
Tell me about Captain Barber, who was the Iwo Jima Silver Star winner and then Medal of Honor winner in the Chosin Reservoir. And I remember he telling, yeah, you know, well, you remember, do you guys remember Sergeant Major Henry?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And we were involved. He wasn't doing too good. He was starting to slow down. And Lieutenant Colonel Gibson, now retired, then Captain Gibson, was very close with him. And we basically, if you go to R8 now, it's called the Henry Rank. Memorial up to him and everything like that. It was a pain in the ass to do it. It was hard to do it. We would love to do it, but it was, you'd be surprised how much red tape and just getting something like that done. And Gibby was the guy who did the work on it. I'm talking to Sergeant Major Henry, and he's telling me about taking Barbara, who also wasn't doing good then. He died like a little while later, to the Iwo Jima Monument and then to the new Korean War Monument. And Barbara says, why do these Marines want to talk to me about tactics? I wasn't in that much combat. I just was on Iwo Jima and the Chosin Reservoir. Sergeant Major Henry didn't need any help. You know? He goes, sir, believe me, because those two battles are what the Marine Corps is all about, just like you said, man.
Well, yeah. You know what's funny is they'll tell you, like, well, so what did you do? Like, hey, look, there wasn't a whole lot of grand tactics going on, man. We fought. Right, we were here, they were there, and we killed them on Iwo Jima. Right, we used everything, you know. And you know, I've read now the Japanese accounts, things I had never heard. Like towards the end of the battle, Marines pumped salt water into caves, right, and then they dumped fuel on top of the water, and then they lit the fuel on fire as a way of burning the Japanese out of the caves. You're reading that going, holy shit, man. I mean, and so it was that kind of barbaric, you know, the kind of combat that Jeff longs for, right? No civilians around, you know, us and them, let's get it the fuck on. And there are no rules, right? Bring your brass knuckles, bring your switchblades, bring anything you could bring, because that's how this thing's going to go.
And those Marines, I can imagine how that idea formed, because we all read Last Can of the Tin Can Sailors, right? And the last part of that book, when they're at sea after they've been sunk, and they're saying, yeah, the lucky thing about being, you know, being when the water's on fire from all the spilled oil is you don't have to worry about sharks. And so here's a Marine probably said, hey, you know what? The water burns. We'll dump salt water in. The fuel on top of it, it'll burn them out from the bottom up.
No, yeah, that's exactly it. Hey, I've got an idea. Yeah. What? Yeah, let's dump. You can imagine exactly how that happens. Like, hey, sir, you know, Smitty back here has got a pretty good idea. I think you should hear it. What is it? And then, you know, let's try it. Yeah. And go ahead, Timmy.
No, I was going to say, I was reading one of those Medal of Honor accounts by a guy named Williams, who was had a flamethrower. And as I'm reading the account, it seems like the decision to use aviation gas in mixture was something they thought up apparently just prior to EO, something that a sergeant had thought up, and they made flamethrowers much more efficient. I didn't know that either. But I do have one thing I found that was interesting this last week, and that is the Medal of Honor recipient Darryl Cole, who the USS Cole was named after, right? And he was a machine gun, I think it was a platoon commander who was killed. He was very proficient. But when he joined the Marine Corps before Pearl Harbor, he admitted to playing in a band in high school and was sent against his will to trumpeter school. So he was a bugler. Then he gets sent to 1-1, does Guadalcanal, Saipan, Tinian, Palau, all the time performing in the machine gun section, wins his thick a Silver Star. But every time he gets out of the battle, he asks, can I please move over and be in the line company and no longer be the bugler? And they're like, no, We don't have any other buglers. and he wasn't made a machine gun, wasn't made in 03 until just before Iwo Jima. But those are the kind of stories you hear about Marines. You know, a guy joins up, he wants to fight up. Ah, it turns out you can play the bugle. You're not going anywhere. You're going to regiment to blow the bugle. I just found that kind of interesting.
No, those stories are crazy. My dad had a friend I grew up with. I want to say his name's Tiny Hansen, and he was a baseball player. And so the Marine Corps said, hey, man, we have, you know, like all service baseball teams. And why don't you join the Marine Corps? Because back in the day, right, those were big championships, the inter-service championships and all that. And you'll come in the Marine Corps and you'll play baseball. And he's like, well, that sounds like not a bad deal. So in September of 1941, he joins the Marine Corps, right, and goes to recruit trade exactly. Where does he find himself? On a boat going to Guadalcanal with the 1st Marine Division. Gets Nambu machine gun to the stomach, right? And he's back in San Francisco by, like, July.
Like, oh, my.
But it's one of those stories. Like Tony Kappa told me. He said, yeah, I was doing sheet metal riveting, you know, in Inglewood, where I grew up, in a factory, and the war starts, and I thought, well, the Navy, you know, they could probably use my help with the aviation and ship holes and stuff like that. So I go down to join. I'm at the MEPS in Los Angeles, and a dude walks in and says, U-9, you're now Marines. And I'm like, what? Like, yeah, you're in the Marine Corps now. Like, all right. I said, did you ever think about that son of a bitch on your way to the beach that day on Iwo Jima? And he said, nah, I had other more pressing things in my head right then. But, you know, he tells a story. He's with the 4th Marine Division. And he's an ammo humper in a machine gun team. Gets made that, you know, right before the landing. And of a 30 caliber, you know, they had both the heavy guns, the water-cooled version, you know, and the light machine guns. And he said, we put the gun in action, and by noon, right, the team leader's dead, the gunner's dead, the A gunner's dead, I'm the only one left. And they reconstitute the team, and we provided, you know, overhead fire every day, you know, to support, you know, the Marines and the rest of the battalion that went forward. He said, I was really lucky.
Iwo Jima and Okinawa, at a certain point, they made the decision not to commit reserves anymore after they put the 3rd Marine Division in. So there was new recruits, and that's where you get the phenomenon of, like, Echo 228 turning over their roster twice. They're just using replacements. They were coming right out of boot camp and going right in, and the other time that was possible, and they did it again, was during Way City. We had guys still wearing batteens, getting killed in 2-5 and then, you know, 1-1 and so forth. Coming off the plane, getting sent to Way City, and dead before dawn. You know?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's Hector Cavaretta's story, right? I mean, he's one of those guys. He doesn't, you know, at the Chosen Reservoir, Medal of Honor guy, joins the Marine Corps, right? Doesn't go to recruit training. He gets trained on going over, you know, to Japan, and then they do the Incheon landing. Then they're up at the Chosen Reservoir, and they fight, and he's wounded, and he's done. He's like in and out of the Marine Corps within, and fought in both at Incheon and at the Chosin, what, in like 6 months? And he went home. And then he gets this letter saying, you've been nominated for the Congressional Medal of Honor. He's like, what?
Major Henry brought him, or Major Henry brought him to the basic school in like 94. And he gave us a talk about that. They had like a camp, kind of like a Marine Poolie camp, where he learned how to take apart and use an M1. But, you know, Jersey, despite being, you know, like a kind of like a junior New York City type, has like a lot of hunting areas. It's got a lot of, you know, unreclaimed areas you can hunt in. He was a hunter. I think he ended up retiring as the fish and game guy for Jersey, the state of New Jersey, when he finally retired. His arm was useless after the battle at Taktong Pass. But he was in Barber's company along with Sergeant Major Henry. Sergeant Major Henry brought him to us, and he said that, yeah, all I had was that camp, and then on the way over they taught us, hey, you know, and then it was, as you know, fight at Incheon, fight for Seoul. Seoul was kind of like a urban battle, you know, pretty much for sure. And then into the, you know, the Chosen Reservoir, you know, that's true. That's, but those guys, they just yanked everybody in, you know, the rapid, that was a unique thing, how they handled the first 6 months of the Korean War, Marine Corps wise. I mean, we just yanked guys in. Half the guy, or like almost 40% of the guys were veterans, and the rest of them were just hit.
Yeah, didn't know anything. And that whole kind of notion that, you know, this was a seasoned Marine Corps that first went over there, that's all bullshit. They cobbled that thing together and got him on ships and sent him. And honestly, the rest, I think, is just, you know, the iron toughness that Marines have always gravitated to the organization because they want to be a part of it. It ain't for everybody. You know, it is, but you know, and that's why I think the few, the proud, you know, is, and maybe you could be one of us, are entirely appropriate in terms of recruiting because it's not for everybody, right? You got to be tough. And when it does get tough, you know, we don't flinch. We tighten our belt and say, let's go, motherfuckers. Let's do it again today because you're going to get your head yanked off. And that's the way we've done it historically. And so but this battle, I agree with Jeff. I mean, it is emblematic. Right. In a lot of ways of what we believe about our Marine Corps.
Because if you go through, you look at Iwo Jima and the attitude those guys have had to develop was, if something doesn't help, it hurts. You get a really clear view of survival attached to victory. You know, we don't have time for bullshit. If this thing doesn't help us survive and win, it helps us fail and die. You know, that's the attitude, right? And that's an attitude that's helped the Marine Corps in crisis times, sure, since.
All right, as we get ready to end this, give me one thought when you think of Iwo Jima, just as recently this year. Give me one thought about it, and then give me, if you were going to tell somebody to read a book about Iwo Jima, what would it be, Timmy?
My one thought is, no matter how hard I try, I don't think I could ever imagine the how hard that was. I don't think I can put it into my own words through my own experiences, because like I said, I've walked that ground, and it's mind boggling the effort it took to secure that terrain, and the fact that we kept going, that nobody ever faltered. Is why Jeff and you and I and everybody else, we feel such immense pride. My one recommendation for a book on Iwo would be Iwo Assault on Hell. It's basically follows the 27th Regiment across using the words of the veterans as they tried to piece together what that regiment did. From guys, Ben's basically what he does is he picks up the narrative on days with guys until they're hit, then he switches to another guy, and it makes for a fascinating reading of men facing adversity that is beyond my ability to even imagine. It's just incomprehensible to me.
So it's called Iwo Assault on Hell.
Iwo Assault on Hell. If you're a Kindle Unlimited member, you get it for free.
Nice, nice.
Or borrow it for free. Yeah. That's a good book.
Jeff, a thought about the that you've had in your head the last few days about the battle, and then a book.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say the book first. The book is Iwo by Richard Wheeler, which is about Iwo Jima writ large, but specifically goes back and forth between what that platoon that actually put the both flags up went through. And this one chokes me up. It's hard. Ira Hayes, his pose on the statue and in the picture, it's just his hands reaching up to the flag. He's not touching it. Now, he had been. It's kind of a doppelganger because he's one of the guys who lifted that thing up. But it seems like he's reaching for it, as if he's saying, I'm dedicating this thing, and I'm going to sacrifice. The way his hands are reaching up, and that always got me about that whole battle. That's what I got to say.
You know, my thought, and I don't know why this sticks in my head, but I think of John Bradley, knowing that he wasn't in that picture. And I think of the pictures of him at the dedication in 1950 or whenever the hell they thereabouts when they dedicated it. Right. He doesn't look like a very happy guy. And I could only imagine, I mean, you know, him looking at that huge bronze, you know, and going, that figure that is supposed to be me has nothing in common with what I wore on that fucking island. And I can't believe none of these monkeys have figured it out yet. And at some point, somebody's going to, and then I'm going to get drugged through the street for being an imposter. Because there's no leggings on that dude. There's no fucking, my pants aren't cuffed. There's no unit ones, and I never took those things off of me that day or whatever the hell they called them. And I didn't have a pair of wire cutters on my fucking thigh, okay? That's not me. And I can't believe these monkeys don't know that, but at some point somebody's got to figure it out because I've seen too many pictures of it, you know? And I just think of just the anguish, you know, that guy, a Navy Cross recipient, who, you know, you hear guys like Chuck Lindbergh say, Lindbergh gets shot through the bicep, and it goes through the bone, but it's a through-and-through wound, and he knows he's okay. He said he went down, and this is, I don't know, two or three weeks after the flag raisings, and he said, Bradley saw me go down, and I screamed, Doc, don't come. I'm all right. And he said, but you couldn't tell Bradley not to come. And he said, and here through, you know, a sniper had already zeroed in on me. And so here comes the corpsman through the same cone of fire, and he said that was John Bradley. And so I don't know why that thought popped in my head that the other day, but that just
is something, Matt. That is really something, because John Bradley's reticence and modesty, reticence to talk about combat with so many of the veterans have, and modesty to not, you know, make himself look big. That is like a trap. I mean, he doesn't want to talk. He wants the whole thing to kind of go away.
Right.
He realized it's emblematic, you know, that he was in the first flag raising, I think, but he wasn't in the iconic one. So yeah, it's a conundrum for him and Ira Hayes and Rene Gagnon. You know, what do you do? How do you act?
Well, and then the two guys that were actually in it that never say a fucking word. The one mentions it to like his stepdaughter casually at dinner, like, yeah, I'm in that picture. The other guy never, ever utters a word. And it tells you, I mean, how different our culture was then, right? Because those guys, if I say that I'm in that picture, do you know the shit I'm going to have to deal with? All the attention I'm going to get? And they were just not like that, right? They didn't want that. They wanted to go home and resume their life. And I remember seeing the guy, the latest guy, and I can't even remember that guy's name. His name's like Peanut Warner or something like that. He's got this quintessentially Midwestern name. And his daughter is talking about, you know, we knew our dad was on the island. We knew he had been wounded. But now to think that my dad raised that flag?
Huh. Hey, I got to tell you all something, and that is hold on.
Let me. And the book I would tell you to read is called Lions of Iwo Jima. And it's written by Fred Haynes, Major General. Right. And I'll tell you what, it's if you haven't read too much about Iwo Jima, it is immensely entertaining in addition to being extremely well written and informative. And it talks about the Marines of the 28th Marines Regiment that went up Mount Suribachi, and the colorful characters in the regiment, to include, you know, Colonel Liversedge, to include Chandler Johnson, and all this other cast of characters. Lions of Iwo Jima comes from the fact that one of the corpsmen for his kid's first birthday, bought a lion from the L.A. Zoo. And he brought it home, and his wife said, get that son of a bitch out of here. And so he takes it to Camp Pendleton. So when they're going to leave to go to Hawaii to train for the Iwo landing, they take the fucking lion with them. And so the lion goes on their daily, like, regimental parade through Hilo. As they, you know, when we used to send the regimental band and the colors and the guard, the duty platoon, right, on the parade, they take the fucking lion with them. right? And so it's just awesome. Honestly, it's extremely well written, you know, by somebody who was there and got out as a major general. So I would. It's called Lions of Iwo Jima. It was only published, I want to say, in 2009 or 10 or something like that. So I'd recommend that. Timmy?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I just wanted to say I'd never thought about Ira Hayes's positioning her hands in that thing and how moving I found that, man. That's why Jeff comes up with some shit, man. But that is an aspect of that monument that I'd never thought of and how well said. I appreciate that. That's cool.
No.
And was that a real lion you're talking about, Mac? Like a lion?
Yes. They have pictures. Oh, they have pictures of the fucking lion on a leash in front of the band walking through Hilo.
That's hysterical.
Yeah, and they would talk shit about the lion. They would say, your battalion is led by jackasses, ours is led by a lion, right? And they and then there's a picture of a first sergeant, right? Using the lion's tail with a cup of shaving cream and putting shaving cream on his face with the fucker's tail. And here's the lion sitting there, and his first sergeant with this, like, handlebar mustache, right? The way we used to do it back in the day. And he's, like, lathering his face using the lion's tail with the lion sitting there looking at him. And, I mean, it's like...
And the other lion's teeth punching holes. Those days, you didn't have tops, you know?
And there's another picture of a dog that they took ashore with them. They find the dog in Hawaii. So they like the dog. The dog becomes like a company pet or a platoon pet or a squad pet or whatever. So now they're getting ready to get on the ship to go to Iwo. Like, well, what do we do with Bowser? And they're like, fuck, let's take him with us. So they take him, and then now they're getting ready to go to shore. Well, what do we do with him? Well, he's a part of the platoon. Fuck, he's got to go. The motherfucker lives through the battle. And they said he thrived on Iwo Jima. Right? He run all over the place, you know, and they show him after, right? And it's like, this is the shit that's hilarious about the Pacific, right? So the guys fight through like Saipan and Iwo Jima, right? And they come home with three ribbons, right? So the dog's got three ribbons on his collar, right? He's got a combat action ribbon, right? The Pacific victory ribbon or whatever that fucker was, and the campaign ribbon for Iwo. And they kept the dog till he died. So it's all kinds of great stories like that. And, you know, the criminals that used to steal beer. And then, you know, then these guys would die on Iwo Jima. You know, John Bazelon, you know, had, you know, lobbied to get out of, you know, raising money on the war bond circuit and go back. I mean, he's killed on day one. And just these colorful guys that inhabited the 28th Marine Regiment. So it's an awesome read. It's a great book. Anyway,
that is a cool story. And of course, you see Marines adopting dogs today over in Afghanistan, but we don't allow that kind of stuff anymore. What a shame.
No. Yeah, no. Less colorful place.
When General Waldhauser's CO of the 15th Mew is during OIF 1, they're moving up. And their battalion for that Mew was a 2-1. 2-1's taking down stuff. And people are bitching because, I guess, Golf 2-1, I could be wrong which company. But everywhere they go, they're seeing G-2-1 spray painted on buildings, spray painted on blown up tanks and shit. Like, spray painted on everything. General Waldhauser tells them, tell them enough of this shit. You know what I mean? It's like people, you know, it's the division doesn't want, or the, you know, the MEF doesn't want to see this type of shit. You know, Marines doing this. And so I guess the battalion commander says, look, sir, we solved this problem. You're not going to see any more Gulf 2-1. And we talked about it. We talked about the men. It's not going to happen. And they're in this, like, they got cami netting up to, you know, block out the sun. And this dog runs by, and the dog's got Gulf 2-1 spray paint. They all broke up laughing. Yeah.
Sorry about that. All right, boys. First of all, you know, I like you guys, I love talking history. I particularly like talking Marine Corps history, and I love talking, you know, the history of the valor that galvanized all of us, and to this day, you know, that still touches all of our hearts, as you could tell by the way we talk about it. So thank you very much for the visit, boys.
Thanks for having us on, Mac.
Thank you.
All right, more of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.